I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Jury selection begins today in the trial of Geronimo Yanez, the Minnesota officer charged with second-degree manslaughter in the death of Philando Castile last year. Castile's girlfriend caught the moments immediately after he was shot on tape. And Tulsa police officer Betty Shelby was acquitted earlier this month in the shooting death of Terrence Crutcher, an unarmed black man. That tragic and disturbing incident was also caught on tape, but it wasn't enough to convict the officer of a crime. Today, a conversation with Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowery. His latest book is called They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. We'll also talk about how Black Lives Matter and the NAACP are reorganizing in the age of President Trump. Plus, remembering Frank DeFord. First, the news. Good afternoon, everybody. Hope you had a nice Memorial Day weekend. Thanks for joining me for Midday this afternoon. I'm Tom Hall. At this hour, in a courtroom in Ramsey County, Minnesota, jury selection is underway in the trial of police officer Geronimo Yanez, accused of second-degree manslaughter in the death of a 32-year-old African-American cafeteria supervisor named Philando Castile during a traffic stop in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, last July. Castile's girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, streamed video of the immediate aftermath of the shooting on Facebook. Protests in Minneapolis and around the world followed. The start of this trial comes on the heels of an acquittal earlier this month in the trial of another officer, Betty Jo Shelby, in Tulsa, Oklahoma. She was found not guilty in the death of Terrence Crutcher, an unarmed black motorist whose shooting was captured on a video taken by police in a helicopter. In both of these cases, the encounters between these motorists and police lasted a very short time. But the ramifications of the legal decisions in these and other cases will last for the foreseeable future. Meanwhile, in Washington, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has been advocating for more federal involvement in local law enforcement instances, mandatory minimum sentences, and other crime-fighting approaches that many criminologists have identified as racially biased, outdated, and ineffective. So today on Midday, a look at the relationship between police and communities of color, the criminal justice system, and the state of activism with groups like Black Lives Matter and the NAACP, which is undergoing a leadership transition. My guest is Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowery. He covers law enforcement, justice, race, and politics for The Washington Post. His latest book is called They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. Wes Lowery, welcome back to Midday.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me.
So it's good to have you back, but it's disheartening, to say the least, to be talking about yet even more incidences of the type that we talked about the last time you were here, a month or two ago. Let's talk first about the trial that's underway today. Jury selection is starting as we speak in the trial of this officer, Geronimo Yanez, a Latino officer. He's charged in the shooting death of Philando Castile. This occurred last July. Remind us of the circumstances of that traffic stop and what happened subsequently.
Of course. And so, again, the death of Philando Castile came after a traffic stop in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, kind of suburban Minneapolis. Philando Castile was driving a vehicle. His girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, was in the car, as well as her daughter was in the back seat. There was a traffic stop. Philando Castile was legally armed, had a concealed carry permit, according to the account given by his girlfriend, had informed the officer he was carrying. And the officer instructed him to provide his driver's license. And as he was doing that, the officer got scared, allegedly thought that Castile was going for his gun, and shoots and kills him. Now, we remember this was in July 2016 and happened, the video of this. Diamond Reynolds, the girlfriend, begins streaming on Facebook Live the moments after Philando's been shot. And so we watch him essentially die in this video. That video came out, and the shooting occurred one day after the video of Alton Sterling being shot and killed in Baton Rouge. And so this was part of a series of shootings, and then ultimately, even after that, a series of officers being killed that made up quite a tense period of time last July that forced us, even if just for a few minutes, away from, at the time, the presidential primaries, and we all started paying attention to police shootings again for a few minutes.
And how do you think that the proximity to the event itself, now we're, 10 months later, we've gone through a searing presidential election in which the divisiveness and the body politic has never been more pronounced. The fact that it is so much further down the road, and Officer Yanez's attorneys applied to the court, petitioned to the court to change the venue out of Ramsey County, which is the jurisdiction in which this crime occurred. What do you think the fact that this happened last summer and so many other things have happened since then, not only the election, but we've had these other deaths. I mean, Jordan Edwards, this young boy in Texas who was killed by a white police officer. He's a freshman in high school, a young African-American student. There have been so many other events. How will these national events impact the trial in Minnesota?
Well, theoretically or hopefully, people would argue that the national events would not impact the trial in Minnesota. But I do think that the reality is the political moment in which we exist means that this already hyper-polarizing idea of prosecuting the police for things they do while on the job, these concepts of police accountability and deaths at the hands of police officers, already remarkably polarizing. And the moment in which we are in now, even further so. So it's very likely to cut in two directions. One, I think you very likely have a populace, probably have residents who feel more strongly in one direction or the other that they might in a less polarized moment. But beyond that, the reality is the current moment we exist in which there's the feeling of a crisis almost every day coming out of Washington, D.C., massive questions about our international alliances and potential Russian interference in our elections. The reality is it's very difficult for any of these stories, no matter how potentially polarizing they are, to boil up into the surface the way they might have just a year or two ago. This is an excellent example. When Philando Castile is killed, this was a story that was receiving wall-to-wall cable news coverage and media coverage. The reality is, I bet most Americans, including most Americans who are interested in this case, probably don't even know that this case is now going to court.
And what is the officer's defense?
Well, in this case, as in most cases of an officer-involved shooting, the officer's defense is tethered to this idea that he was in fear for his life. The way that the legal standard operates for police officers in the United States of America, it is not that they have to prove that they were correct to be in fear of their life, but rather, as long as they had a reasonable fear at the time and were actually afraid, they can more or less do whatever they want. So again, in this case, Officer Geronimo has no, Officer Jimenez has no obligation to have correctly seen Philando Castile reaching for a gun or even to have seen a gun at all. If he believed at the time that Castile may have been reaching for a gun, he's got some legal justification. Now, what's going to be interesting in this case is there is audio evidence, audio from the dash camera as well as from a camera, I believe, that he may have been wearing that will capture the details and the specifics of this interaction. If I remember correctly, in charging the officer here, prosecutors said that the audio evidence did not match up with the story told by the officer about the shooting. That's going to be key as well. What we see very often is that it's very difficult to pin a large crime on an officer, a manslaughter, a murder, right? Because again, we give legal wiggle room to our officers. Our police officers are in fact allowed to kill people, right? But what is different, what is a different standard and was often easier to get an officer on is if there's clear evidence of some type of cover-up. If there's a clear lie, we can watch a video and then you said this thing happened, but the video shows something else. Or if there's audio, hey, I identified myself as an officer and I said X, Y, and Z, and then the audio doesn't have that. And so I think that evidence, much of which has not been released yet, is what I'm really interested in seeing in this case moving forward.
because Mr. Castile's girlfriend has said in the media that it was Mr. Castile himself who informed the officer of the fact that he was carrying a firearm. And he said, I'm going to reach into my pocket or something to the effect of, I am carrying a firearm, but I'm not going for my gun. I'm going to reach into my pocket to get my license, which you've asked for. So there is, you know, perhaps there is audio evidence of that, you know, interaction between the officer and Mr. Castile. But as we've seen in other cases, the mere existence of audio tape or videotape by no means guarantees a particular outcome. I mean, there have been, for example, this situation in Tulsa, where, people all around the world saw what happened in that interaction. That was simply not enough to convict Officer Shelby in that case.
Of course. Well, you have that case, and you also have the Walter Scott case. Which had occurred in early 2015, where Michael Slager is found, ends up having a mistrial after being charged with the murder of Walter Scott. This being a case where the two had struggled over a taser, where Walter Scott had clearly broken away and was running away. And we can watch on a bystander video Slager take his gun out and line up his aim and shoot Walter Scott in the back. That was a case, it was a case that, to say it went viral is an understatement at the time. This was the exact type of thing that people had been said was happening. You know, here you had this unarmed black man running away, getting bullets put in his back. And the reality was it did not result in a conviction of Michael Slager. Now, ultimately, he, agreed to an agreement with federal prosecutors over federal crimes, but he was not convicted of a state crime for that shooting.
He did, in fact, plead guilty to this federal civil rights charge. But again, it was a federal charge, not in the local jurisdiction. Before we take a break, let's talk a little bit about this just horrifying case in Texas of this young kid named Jordan Edwards. About 3 weeks ago, the officer involved in that shooting, a man named Roy Durwood Oliver, surrendered himself after he was charged with murder. Originally, there was a story that the officer put out there that said that the car that Jordan Edwards was driving in, he was a passenger, was backing towards the officer and, tethering his defense or his explanation to a fear for his life. But later on, and not too much later on, evidence to the contrary emerged. So tell us what we understand about what happened in that incident and where that stands in terms of the next legal step.
Sure, of course. And this was a tough case, as many of them are, in part because this Jordan Edwards was a 15-year-old boy. Among the youngest at the time was the youngest person who'd been shot and killed. I think since there's been another 15-year-old as well as maybe a 14-year-old as well. But had been the youngest person shot and killed by police so far this year at the time he was killed. Now, Jordan Edwards was a high school student at a party. The police had gotten a call about an unruly party. This was a Saturday night or a Sunday night. Officers arrived, began breaking up the party, and then according to the police accounts, as they were breaking up the party, heard gunshots going off outside. And so these officers run outside. As they run outside, they see a car backing out of a driveway to drive away. Now, what we've heard from Jordan Edwards' family is that they had been at this party. Kids had been at this party. Things had gotten rowdy. The police had gotten called. And so Jordan Edwards said, hey, take me home. Let's get out of here. His friends start to leave. And then they hear the gunshots as well. Now they definitely want to get out of there. But what we know is that two officers begin approaching the vehicle as it's attempting to drive away. One officer, it appears, according to the police accounts, calls out or shouts. But the second officer, Roy Oliver, takes his weapon out and discharges it through what we believe is the passenger side of this car, leaving Jordan Edwards shot and killed. Initially, the police had come out and they'd said that this car had aggressively driven backwards at the officers. It essentially had charged the officers and that this officer had to open fire. But what happened was that this officer was wearing a body camera. Now, this video has not been released. We have not seen it. But after the police chief, who went to the podium and advanced the story that Jordan Edwards was in a car that was aggressively driving an officer. He watched the video, and then he called another press conference, and he said that, in fact, what he saw in that video did not hold up to the standards of the department, that he raised the likelihood that in this video you had a shooting of not a car driving aggressively at an officer, but perhaps, as Jordan Edwards' family has said, of a car driving away. And so it's raised a real question about what comes next and what happens next. The officer's been discharged. There's questions about, and I believe charged as well. And so there's, but on top of that, in policing in general, there's been a long conversation for decades about whether or not officers should shoot at moving vehicles. And so this also opened a policy conversation that has been going on about, one, what was this car doing? Two, if it was not charging the officers or driving aggressively, why was that the initial story? But three, should any officer be firing at a vehicle at all? And it's been interesting to kind of watch this play out and continue to have these conversations.
Wesley Lowery covers justice, law enforcement, race, and politics for The Washington Post. Before joining the staff of The Post, he reported for The Boston Globe, The Los Angeles Times, and The Wall Street Journal. We're going to have more with Wesley Lowery when we come back from a break. If you'd like to join our conversation, 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Our email, midday@wipr.org. To follow us at Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around.
Let it be known that I believe in my heart that Betty Shelby got away with murder.
Terrence was not the aggressor. Betty Shelby was the aggressor. Betty Shelby had the gun. Betty Shelby was following him with his hands up. Betty Shelby murdered my brother.
The father and sister of Terrence Crutcher, who was shot to death by Tulsa, Oklahoma police officer Betty Shelby. He was African American. Officer Shelby is white. He was unarmed. She was acquitted by a jury in Tulsa earlier this month. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, we're talking about people like Terrence Crutcher and Philando Castile, who was carrying a legally registered gun when he was killed during a traffic stop in Falcon Heights, Minnesota last summer. Jury selection is underway today in the trial of the officer who has been indicted in that case, Geronimo Yanez. One of the most shocking incidents of use of force by police is Jordan Edwards, a teenager who was shot to death by a police officer in Balch Springs, Texas, while he was a passenger in a car that was driving away from the officer. My guest today is Wesley Lowery, a reporter at The Washington Post who has covered the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, Freddie Gray, who died from injuries he sustained when he was arrested by Baltimore police, and many subsequent cases. Earlier this month, Lowery reported that since January of 2015, nearly 200 people have been killed by police while they were in a vehicle. In 76 of those cases, the victims were not armed with a weapon, although police often insist the cars that they were driving in were constituted, or they rather did constitute a weapon. So we'll talk about that and other aspects of the deep divide that still exists between law enforcement and communities of color. You are welcome to join us here on Midday. 410-662-8780 is our phone number, our email, midday@wipr.org, and to follow us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. So, Wes Lowery, you report recently in The Post that since January 2015, 193 people who were inside vehicles when they were shot. We were talking about a little bit about this before we took a break. This notion that the car that people are driving in, they're either driving it themselves or they're a passenger, is in and of itself a weapon. Is certainly a very real concern for police if someone's going to try to run them over. The Post is the first media organization to track police shootings and to track deaths in police custody. What are you finding when you parse the numbers of the data that you all are now putting out there?
Sure. I think one thing that is important to look at and I think we quoted some folks as talking about this in that article, was this question of, there's not a question that a moving vehicle can pose a physical and perhaps deadly threat to an officer. We've unfortunately had officers who've been run over, who've been struck and killed. There are people who will attempt to use a car and drive it out, officers or whatnot. But the question, although that is not the case in Jordan Edwards, based on what we're led to believe, but the question remains, what is the best practice of officers when confronted with a vehicle? And what many people say is that in most cases, the best thing to do is get out of the way of the car, right? As opposed to pausing and pulling your gun and discharging it, that the best thing to do is jump out of the way. Now, one of the things that's interesting here is, you know, we see this. We have this conversation very often about shooting at moving vehicles, either someone who is fleeing in a moving vehicle or someone who is perhaps coming at you. Now, the best case scenario, if you shoot at a moving vehicle, is that with one single shot, you immediately incapacitate the driver of that car, right? That's the best, you know, you don't have to discharge multiple times, you don't miss, you don't, right? So in that best case scenario, though, what you have done is created a multiple ton bullet flying down the street with no one driving it, right? You have killed the driver of the car, and you now have the car that was driving at you is probably still driving at you, right? And so this is one of the things that folks set out, and that's not even beginning to factor in the idea of you might have multiple officers firing. They might be firing from different sides of the car. You could have bystanders be hit by those bullets. You could have people who are not the driver of the car be hit by those bullets, right? It's a moving target. You could miss it. And so it's this question about what is the danger created by firing at moving vehicles, and does that outweigh the imminent and immediate need for officers to kind of rectify their own safety? And so that's one of the things that we talked about. Again, we've seen hundreds of these shootings, hundreds of people who would not be dead were departments to more strictly abide by the policies similar to ones that the NYPD and other major departments have, where they say, look, don't shoot at moving vehicles. It's more dangerous than it's worth. Jump out of the way. And so there's a real question about whether or not more departments should adopt these policies. On the other hand, what a lot of the departments would say is that if you have a terrorist driving into a crowd, or, you know, in some cases, the only thing to do is to shoot at the car. And so that's kind of the fault line of this debate. But what we know is that departments that have stricter policies about shooting at vehicles end up killing fewer people.
And the circumstances are obviously unique and different in every case. Mm-hmm. But in 76 of the cases that you've followed, of the 193 people who were inside vehicles at the time that they were shot, there was the person who was killed was not armed with a particular firearm or a knife or something like that. They were unarmed, and they were armed with nothing other than the car they were driving in. And of course, an officer in that very split second moment isn't going to know necessarily, unless he or she is shot at. He's not going to know whether or not the people in the car are armed in any way, right?
Sure. Well, unless there had been some type of exchange previously, you know, perhaps this is someone who there had been a shootout with, and he ran and jumped in the car and now is driving away. You know, so there are ways where they might know, but in many of these cases, because, you know, as we pointed out, in not a few cases, you have people who are otherwise completely unarmed driving in cars, many of them driving away, some of them fleeing, and then you also have these cases where it's a toss-up, where the officer says the car was driving at me, and the person who was driving the car is now dead. They've been shot and killed. Now, what we know is that in at least some of those cases, video evidence or audio evidence later disproves the version of the officers. They say the car was driving at them, but then we watch the video and perhaps it was not. And so there's a real question of how often are officers being, you know, directly physically targeted by moving vehicles like this, and if the number of shootings around these should not be a smaller number.
There's a couple of items of breaking news just today. This comes from WCPO in Cincinnati, Ohio, in the retrial of an officer named Ray Tensing, who shot a man named Sam DuBose in 2015. That retrial has been put on hold, and the hang-up is media access, whether or not people are going to be allowed in the courtroom, et cetera, to cover this. Do you know anything about that particular trial and the circumstances surrounding that?
Sure, a little bit. I haven't followed all the details specifically of the trial and now retrial, but I remember the shooting well, that of Sam DuBose, who was shot and killed an unarmed black man shot and killed near the University of Cincinnati by Ray Tensing, who was a University of Cincinnati police officer. And in that case, there had been a traffic stop. Sam DuBose did not have his license on him. And they had a back and forth. At some point, Sam DuBose attempts to pull away from the officer, who pulls his gun, points it in the car, and ultimately shoots and kills Sam DuBose. This was a case, again, captured on body camera. At the time, there were real questions about whether anything would happen. Now, Cincinnati, for people who live there, has the memory of some unrest and some violence after a police shooting in the late 90s. And so there is definitely a city that was on edge. But ultimately, the local authorities decided to charge Ray Tensing for this shooting, in part because the body camera showed clearly a version that seemed a little different than his version. Now, that said, it's remarkably difficult to charge a police officer for an on-duty shooting. It happens in in less than one half of 1% of the police shootings. But that said, convictions are even more rare. The reality is it's just difficult for juries and for judges to conclude that on-duty shootings are criminal. In most cases, we give our police officers the benefit of the doubt. Now, that becomes difficult for families, for civil rights organizations, for the public in many communities, because there's this feeling of impunity that these officers that we're watching on video, these shootings that many people agree should not have happened, and yet there seems to be no legal recourse. And I think that's something we're seeing in kind of case after case, whether it be the Walter Scott case, whether it be the decision not to indict officers in many of these other cases, whether it be Michael Brown or Tamir Rice or in Freddie Gray in Baltimore, the mistrial and the decision to drop the charges for the officers. It's very difficult for the public to feel as if officers are being held to account when they can watch, on one hand, these videos, and on the other hand, they hear this news that there's been another mistrial or the charges have not been, have been dropped or declined to be brought.
And we have other news coming out just this morning, again from Ohio, this time in Cleveland. One of the officers involved in the shooting of Tamir Rice, that 12-year-old kid who was shot in Cleveland in 2014, he has been fired from the Cleveland Police Department. Cleveland.com says that the officer, Timothy Lehman, was fired not because of his actions in the killing of Tamir Rice, but for lying on his police application. There are officers here in Baltimore who were indicted in the death of Freddie Gray, who also face, Baltimore Sun is reporting a week or so ago that some of those officers are facing dismissal from the department. So not every case goes to trial, but sometimes police departments themselves are taking action against these officers. Perhaps one of the most high-profile cases to not go to trial is that of the death of Alton Sterling. And the Justice Department decided not to pursue charges in that case. And again, there was a video that millions of people saw in which the officers, appeared to be having their knees on Mr. Sterling's back at the time that they shot him to death. What is the relevance, the importance, the significance of the fact that we now have a Justice Department being run by Jeff Sessions in a Donald Trump administration when it comes to the federal government's proclivity for prosecuting cases like that of Alton Sterling? They ultimately decided not to. And what was their justification, and what does this bode moving forward?
So the federal government has two forms of oversight over local police departments. Because remember, here in the federalism of our government, we are run by local elected officials. We elect our sheriffs and our prosecutors. Our police chiefs serve at the pleasure of our mayors and our city councils. The feds do not control our local policing. We have 18,000 and 19,000 individual police departments that do more or less what they want to do. Make their own rules, create their own processes, hire and fire their own. The federal government has two forms of oversight. The first is that they can pursue civil rights charges against any officer deemed to have knowingly violated the civil rights of a citizen. Now, there's an extremely, extremely high burden of proof for a federal civil rights charge. That you actively and knowingly denied someone's civil rights is a very high bar. We see very rarely are there those charges filed. The second form of oversight is the so-called patterns and practice investigation. And what happens in these cases is that the federal government comes in, and usually because of the complaints of a citizen or a particularly bad shooting, and they investigate the police department. They request a bunch of records. They compel them to give them a lot of data. They look over complaints. And what they are attempting to do is trying to figure out, is it true that this department as a whole has a pattern and a practice of denying civil rights of some of its residents? If they can prove that, and they do in many of the cases, if they can prove that, they lay out a findings letter where they're making the argument that this department routinely or as a pattern and practice violates civil rights of its residents. And then it essentially, the Department of Justice is going to threaten to sue this department to force them into an agreement for some level of reforms, right? And so those are the two tools the federal government has. The reality is it's very difficult to file federal charges. It's not something that happens very often. And under the current Justice Department, there's now been a reluctance, and sounds like there will be a reluctance, to use the patterns and practices. Now, both of these tools were tools that are given to the federal government in the 90s after Rodney King. And the Patterns and Practices Report was not something that – or the investigatory power was not something that was being used very broadly until the Obama years. This was something that the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice under President Obama began using very aggressively, launching dozens of these investigations. We've read the reports, the Chicago Report or the Ferguson Report, where they lay out all of these ways. What Attorney General Sessions has said is essentially that he doesn't believe in these reports. He thinks they're anecdotal or they're not fair to the departments. Now, he has also said that he hasn't read any of these investigations, and so take that as you may. But essentially, his argument has been that it is not a problem of bad departments and bad systems. Rather, it's a problem of bad Apple officers. Now, this is difficult because if you don't believe in using patterns and practices investigations, it means the only thing you can do, the only tool you have is civil rights charges. But again, civil rights charges are very difficult. In the Alton Sterling case, they were unable to bring them. They've been debating the Eric Gardner case now for almost 3 years. They weren't able to bring them against George Zimmerman in Florida or Darren Wilson in Missouri, right? And so, again, the Department of Justice in many ways has backed itself into a corner. It doesn't like, people close to Attorney General Sessions don't like that he's described as being soft on the police or anti-accountability. He wants to be able to charge bad officers, except that he cannot, and he's refused to use the other tool he has on the table.
Before we take a break, we have an email from Mary in Baltimore who says, not in any way to take away from the tragedies of police shootings, but isn't it clear the police departments across the country need better training than what they appear to be currently receiving? And of course, we know here in Baltimore all about patterns and practices because the police department and the city are under a consent decree, which is being overseen by a federal judge, to improve their very bad record of unconstitutional treatment of citizens. They were called out by the Obama Justice Department last summer, and training is the mantra that the mayor of Baltimore, Mayor Catherine Pugh, has invoked when it comes to what's at the heart of the consent decree that's in effect here. In your reporting about this across the country, I mean, are you finding that police departments are modifying, improving, changing in a dramatic way the kinds of training that they're offering their officers?
I haven't seen dramatic changes in training. There certainly have been conversations, and there are conversations that were going on predating our current kind of moment about this, but there have certainly been conversations about how officers should be best trained, if there should be additional implicit bias training, if there should be conversations about getting rid of old conventions in policing, whether it be the so-called 21-foot rule, where if you get within 21 feet of me with a knife, I can kill you no matter what you're doing, right? These types of kind of phrases that officers memorize that may or may not be based in real police science, right? And so there's certainly been a conversation. There have been think tanks, groups like the PERF, which is the Police Executive Research Forum, and others who have been advancing and advocating specific types of reform. The reality is, again, there are 19,000 departments that decide what their own training standards are, decide what academies they use, what videos their cadets are shown, right? And so it's very difficult when you don't have a national standardization of police training. You could get the five biggest departments to all agree to do a new type of training, and it actually wouldn't have impact policing in most of America, right? And so it's really there's a back and forth, a push and pull here, where you're certainly seeing some places embrace new and different types of training, and other places not really.
Wesley Lowery is a reporter for The Washington Post and the author of They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. After a break, we'll have more on the criminal justice system and activism for racial equality in the age of Donald Trump and Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who has called for a return to crime-fighting strategies that were often employed in the 1990s. You are welcome to join our conversation when we return from a break. 410-662-8780 or our email address, midday@wipr.org. And before we take that break, it is our practice on Mondays to acknowledge the names of people who have fallen victim to violence in the city of Baltimore. We aired an archive edition of Midday yesterday on the Memorial Day holiday, so we will take a moment today to recognize the people who have lost their lives violently and to stand in sympathy with their families. So far this year, 144 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, 8 people were the victims of homicide in our city. They are Dorian Lumpkins, age 20, Bruce Chester, age 66, Maurice Stovall, age 33, Tyrone Dickens, age 27, Dorian Faulkner, age 29, two men whom police have yet to identify, one of whom was 28 years old, and Reese Bowman. He was an infant. He was just 8 months old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a conversation with Dr. Miho Tanaka. She's an orthopedic surgeon and the director of the Women's Sports Medicine Program at Johns Hopkins Hospital. The Baltimore 10-miler is coming up this weekend. That's a popular running race that includes jaunts around Druid Hill Park and Lake Montebello. Runners will be hitting the streets, and Dr. Tanaka will have some tips on how to keep those joints and bones feeling good after that kind of workout, or whatever your workout of choice is as the summer gets underway. So I hope you can join us tomorrow with Dr. Miho Tanaka here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Wesley Lowery, a reporter who, since the killing of Michael Brown by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, has covered law enforcement, justice, race, and politics for The Washington Post. He is the author of They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. To join our conversation, give us a call at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wipr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. So, Wes Lowery, let's talk about the groups that in the last several years, groups like Black Lives Matter, and the you wrote about the change in their strategy, the change in how they are reacting to these various events that continue to occur. This Black Lives Matter movement grew out of the incident in Ferguson a few years ago. But Black Lives Matter appears to be tactically taking a different course. How so?
Well, you know, I think the Black Lives Matter or the movement for Black Lives more broadly, right, because there's always the back and forth between the individual group called Black Lives Matter versus when we use that to invoke kind of the broader set of organizations and activists who, who've been protesting in recent years. I think that they, like many people, were kind of stunned by what happened in November. We're not necessarily prepared for President Trump and what activism in the era of President Trump would look like. You had an assumption by many of the activists that Hillary Clinton would be the president and that they would be pressuring a Democrat who was attempting to court their favor, and they'd be pressuring her to do more of what they wanted to do. That is fundamentally different than the reality that we exist in now, in which you have President Donald Trump and Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who are diametrically opposed to many of the goals and the desires and demands of many of these young activists. You know, again, we have to remember, Black Lives Matter had representatives meeting in the White House not infrequently during the Obama years, and I would be very surprised if in the 4 years of the Trump presidency, or however long the Trump presidency lasts, if at any point any of these young leaders are brought into the White House, right? Totally different tenor, totally different tone, which raises questions about what are the best tactics and strategies, what is the best theory of change for these organizations in this moment. I think what we've seen in many cases, with many of the most prominent both activists and organizations, is we've seen an attempted expansion of coalition building, where you're seeing many of these groups lead the fights and the marches around things like the travel ban or questions about Islamophobia. How are we dealing with Muslims? How are we dealing with immigrants? We have to remember that a large portion of our undocumented immigrants are from Africa, are Black. And so we've seen many of these, or for Caribbean islands, right? So we've seen many of these groups play a role in the immigration conversations as well. It's not as, you know, what we've not seen is a massive march and a massive collective action after every single police shooting, although it was always perhaps a little, you know, crazy for us to expect that to be what happened, that for the rest of forever there would always be massive protest every time there was a shooting. There are three fatal police shootings every single day.
It was the sheer volume of them almost makes that just impossible.
You couldn't do it, right? You know, and by doing it a tenth time, you start to lose the momentum of it. And so what we've seen, I think, has been a much more, you know, in many ways a more private conversation than it has been public at times. But I think we've also seen maturation in some spaces, but I also I'll say that to say that there's also there have also always been people in these spaces attempting to do the policy work. You have organizations that have always been attempting to put out platforms, attempting to work within systems as opposed to agitating outside of them, and so it's not a full-fledged pivot, I don't think, for the activism space. But there are certainly are a lot of differences the day after Donald Trump is elected as opposed to the day before.
What about the NAACP, the country's largest and oldest civil rights organization? The board of the NAACP decided to dismiss the current president, the Reverend Cornell William Brooks. He'd been in that job 3 years. What do you make of that? Does that indicate a change of direction for the NAACP as well?
Yes and no. So yes, again, Cornell Brooks was removed as the president of the NAACP, the oldest civil rights organization in the nation. Mr. Brooks had been very involved in demonstrations across the country, been very involved in fights first to get Loretta Lynch confirmed as attorney general and later to oppose Jeff Sessions as attorney general, had traveled to the Fergusons and elsewhere during unrest Baton Rouge. And so this is certainly a shift as the board removes him, arguing they want to go in kind of a different direction. It's unclear exactly what that direction is right now. But it's consistent with the history of the NAACP in that the NAACP has, in modern history, had real difficulty retaining leadership. There's been a turnover of the CEO of this organization many times in the last 20, 30 years. And it's raised this question over and over again of what is the role of this organization today? How does it best operate in this new environment with new technology, with a new media cycle, with many more people who can now speak out for themselves? What is the role of an organization like this? And so I think it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out and what direction they go in next.
I should say probably more accurately that the Black Lives Matter movement really sprang out of a reaction to Trayvon Martin's killing by George Zimmerman mm-hmm. back in 2013. But it is interesting that as time goes on, now we're 4 years from that event, that these organizations, and certainly the NAACP has been, you know, on the scene for many, many years, maturing process continues with both of these organizations, that they are looking to do different things. And you know, here's the NAACP choosing to do policy stuff, worrying about appointments of Loretta Lynch, Jeff Sessions, and Black Lives Matter perhaps picking up some of that mantle and talking about policy strategy rather than just demonstrations every day.
Of course, and it's going to really continue to be interesting to see how these organizations build and nurture relationships between them. You know, I think sometimes we set them up as kind of diametrically opposed to each other, and they don't necessarily exist that way. They can exist in a complementary mosaic because the reality is there are many similar goals, even if very often the tactics and the politics might be a little bit different. Said, I know I am, and many people I think are watching very closely what happens with NAACP because I just find it very fascinating and very interesting about, you know, in this moment, what comes next.
Before we have to let you go, a couple of things I want to ask you about. One is the death of a man named Edward Skeeta Crawford, who was very involved in 2014 mm-hmm. during the protests in Ferguson. He died after what police are calling a self-inflicted wound. They're calling it a suicide. What do you know about that case?
Sure. So Edward Crawford, for your listeners, is the man from what is probably the most memorable image from Ferguson, Missouri. This was the young black man with dreadlocks who's wearing the American flag, wife beater shirt, tank top, who is throwing a can of tear gas back towards the police officers with a bag of chips in his other hand. This was an image taken by Robert Cohen over at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on August 13th, 2014, so 4 days after Michael Brown had been killed, and immediately went viral, became kind of one of the enduring symbols. Now, Edward was someone I'd met a few nights earlier than that. My first night in Ferguson, he was one of the first people I interviewed. I remember talking to him and how upset he was about everything that was happening here in his neighborhood, this anger, this unrest, this violence, this concern, and this concern that there was so much excitement and so much going on, but that nothing might change in the long run. That Ferguson was going to be a place we all paid attention to until we didn't. Now, Edward, had a brush with fame almost, became one of these images, these faces of Ferguson. And then he was right. The cameras left. The people disappeared. Life continued being hard and difficult. So Edward Crawford was found. He'd been riding, according to the police, he'd been riding in the backseat of a car with two women he knew. He began talking about being depressed and being upset, and then moments later, according to them, he pulled a gun out and shot himself in that car.
And we're going to continue to cover this. And Wes, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to call it a day. But thank you very much for your time and your reporting on this. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Wesley Lowery, the author of They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and the New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us. So before we go today, we'd like to take a moment to remember Baltimore native Frank DeFord, who died this weekend. I interviewed him about a couple of his books, including a memoir that he wrote about his career as a sports writer. Here's part of a conversation we had back in 2012.
I have one of those rare opportunities to talk to people about sports who don't necessarily care about sports.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend, a novelist, Mike Mushaw, who says, I think I quote this.
Yeah, it's in the book.
This in the book. He says, you spent so many years, and still do, writing about people who don't read, that is, athletes. And now you speak on the radio to people who don't know what you're talking about.
There's a niche for you, huh?
Is that sui generis? I think so.
Yeah.
But really, that is a tremendous opportunity for me, because it's so unusual, because the sports is usually over in the corner, and mm-hmm. so that does set me apart from just about anybody.
Yeah. Frank DeFord speaking with me in 2012. One of the things that set him apart was his enormous body of work. He wrote more than 20 books. He was an acclaimed magazine writer, a commentator on NPR, and even a pitchman for Miller Beer. He was also a gracious and kind man who will be missed by his legions of readers and listeners. Frank DeFord died Sunday at the age of 78. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. You've been listening to Midday. We appreciate it. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.